Ready to start because it's 6:30. I'm John Mayer, I chair the LSE Media Group. Thank you all for coming through the rain, and there'll be other people coming, I'm sure, as we go on. The LSE Media Group is made up of what the LSE calls alumni of the LSE, who work in and around the media, and it includes some very distinguished people, some of whom are here tonight, like Clive Jones and David Doherty and Jana Bennett and Lloyd Grossman. Now, Lloyd, it's little known that Lloyd has an MPhil from this institution in gin drinking in the 17th century, correct? And I think he would like to register for a PhD here, so he could become Dr. Grossman before very long. Lloyd founded the media group 10 years ago. His meetings were rather more ornate. They were held in the Shaw Library, and they were sponsored by Victoria Wine. At one of those meetings, I was going up in the lift, and I met Greg Dyke, and I said, what are you doing here? You didn't come here. He said, no, but my wife did, though. Which seemed to be a qualification. His partner certainly came here. She just told me she did a BA in sociology in 1969 to 72. But it's taken us 2 years to get Greg here. I've been writing him for 2 years ever since the stakes for the DG were first set out. And I wrote to him and said, would you like to come and tell us your plan for the BBC? And he wrote back and said, that's a very interesting idea, but no, thank you. Others wrote back equally in equally obtuse ways. He's a man who's kept his word. We've gone and gone at him and said, would you like to come and do this? He said, yes, he would. Eventually, we've got him here. He is the most unusual DG of recent years. Some would say the most charismatic. He's like a dose of salts in the BBC. He's put in a pot under it, and we're just waiting for the results to come out at the other end. Ladies and gentlemen, Lloyd Grossman and Greg Dyke.
Here we are. Welcome to you all. Actually, it's very uncomfortable not being able to face the audience. Can you hear if we don't use these mics? Oh, well, that's got us off to a great start, hasn't it? Okay. Right. Let me just move this around because I do want to be facing you. I think that's a bit better. Fine. Thank you for that introduction, John. Welcome to the Old Theatre, especially for those of you who may not have been here before. I think that includes most LSE students who strenuously try to avoid the place. It has provided a stage for many extraordinarily significant people, Madeleine Albright, George Soros, our own Tony Giddens, who wrote not too long ago that the position of the BBC, this isn't embarrassing, I promise you, the position of the BBC, like that of public broadcasters in most other countries, is under strain and has been subject to much controversy. The future of the BBC has become problematical because of the proliferation of new forms of media technology. Well, I'm sure we'll talk about that later on. Tonight, it's the turn of Greg Dyke, who I could describe in Maoist terms as the great helmsman of the problematical supertanker of British broadcasting. It's time for the great helmsman to share the stage at the Old Theatre this evening. Now, in spite of having got off to a really rather disadvantaged start in life, namely, he was an undergraduate at York University, in spite of that, Greg did become editor-in-chief of TVAM, managing director-in-chief executive of LWT, chief executive of Pearson Television, and chairman of Channel 5. And since January 2000, he has been director general of the BBC and unquestionably the most influential person in British broadcasting. So, welcome to you, Greg. Right, yesterday, the BBC published One Year On, which was a review of your first year as Director General. Your triumphs include Castaway, Simon Sharma's History of Britain, winning back the FA Cup for television, and, of course, Bob the Builder, which was the best-selling single of the year. What were the low points?
Well, you can take Bob the Builder both ways, can't you?
I like Bob the Builder.
Yeah, good. I thought you might. The low points. Well, the lowest point was losing the rights to Match of the Day. I mean, we lost at a price that we wouldn't have paid, so we couldn't complain. But it was a pretty... if actually we'd announced winning the FA Cup the day before, as opposed to the day after, it would have been seen as 50-50, but unfortunately it didn't come that way. And therefore we had a terrible day. We knew we'd won the FA Cup back, but we couldn't announce it. And we had a pretty bad day in the press. And also, Match of the Day is a sort of one of those programmes at the BBC that has been there for a long time. Although we have lost it twice before to ITV, and both times they pulled out. So we're quite optimistic they'll do the same again.
On balance, how would you grade your first year? Would you give yourself a gold star for year one?
I wouldn't give myself a grade at all. I give myself a grade star. I'm still there, really. I think you can't do that because it's too early to say. I mean, you've got to look at what I set out to do, and we're only a fairly short distance along the path. I mean, what was important was convincing the organisation that its role was pretty simple, and that is to produce and to broadcast, or to produce or to commission and broadcast great television, radio and online services. Somebody gives you, thankfully, £2.2 billion a year to spend to do that, and the aim is to see how good a quality product you can get. Now, I think at times the BBC had forgotten that that's its role. When I set off, one of the first things we did was to, having worked all my life run in the last decade profit and loss companies, I sat in the BBC and I thought, having got the job, I'm not quite sure how you judge this sort of organisation. I mean, profit and loss companies are easy to judge. Either your profits are going the right way or in the end you're in trouble, as most of the dot-com businesses have discovered in recent weeks. The BBC isn't that, of course. It's public service, but what does public service actually mean? It means serving the public. How do you judge that? How do you judge the success of that? And one of the early things I came up with was it's quite clear that you're taking money from the public in a poll tax, effectively. And the most important thing is to make sure the vast majority of that money, the maximum you can achieve, it gets spent on providing a service for the public. So I brought in some people who did an audit very early on, and we discovered we were spending 76% of our money on the programmes and services, which effectively meant we were spending 24% on running the institution of the BBC. And I mean, I think instinctively, once we got that figure, we knew it was too high. And therefore, a lot of the last year has been working out how to reduce that. And our plan is over 4 years, we will change 24% to 15%. Now, I presume this is a problem in every publicly funded organisation. How do you stop the overhead growing to such an extent that it's taking more and more, of the income? So we've spent a lot of time this year doing that. If you can achieve it over that 4 years, we will have an extra £200 million a year to spend on programmes and services, which in terms of radio and television is a lot of money. At the same time, we got an increase in the licence fee above inflation for the next 5 years, which was a fair increase. And thirdly, we started looking about other ways of bringing in more commercial income into this organisation. Between the three of them, we then said, OK, we reckon by the year 2001, 2002, we will be able to increase... No, 2002, three, sorry. We will be able to increase all our budgets by a total of £450 million a year. So the first thing was get the money. The second thing, making any creative business, is have you got the talent? And can you attract the talent? And that required something different inside the BBC. I think a lot of very talented people had left. I mean, there were still an awful lot of talented people there. But creative people need to work in an environment which they find happy and conducive and exciting and interesting. So a lot of the time has been spent trying to do that. So I suspect 20% of my time is actually spent on communication inside the organisation. And the third thing, so you need money, you need talent, and the third thing you need is luck, really. Because we've all... and that doesn't... you can't assume from the first two that all your new programming will work, because it's a creative process, and anyone who's involved in creative process, be it theatre, be it cinema, be it anything, be it writing, knows that you can put together all the ingredients to make something wonderful and you make a pile of garbage. I mean, we've all done it. the only trick is to recognise it and get out of it as fast as you can, really. So the real test comes over the next couple of years when we begin to spend this money, which we haven't yet spent. We've just started spending it. And in this document, which we largely produced 1 year on, which we largely produced for the staff. I mean, we distributed to every member of staff, because I think it's incredibly important. And what it says is, this is what we said we were going to do in this year, this is what we've achieved, this is what we haven't done, this is what needs to be done. We've outlined where we're going to spend the money.
You've said it's very difficult to come up with meaningful performance indicators for a public service company as opposed to a standard profit and loss company.
Well, a profit and loss company is easy.
Yeah. But presumably another difference is the difference in the internal culture between a public service organization like the BBC and a profit and loss company. Have you found that to be particularly challenging or difficult?
It's interesting. We had a big meet. I have a monthly meeting of about 90 people, which we had this morning, which was senior management from across the whole BBC, where we do all sorts of things. And it's about getting different bits of the BBC to understand what's happening. It always struck me as nuts that the first time anybody at the BBC knew what was in the BBC One's schedule was when they read about it in the press. So you've got to try and inform people a lot earlier than that. It's a communication meeting. And this morning we have an outside speaker every month, because again, the danger of big organisations, probably like the LSE and the rest of it, is that they become terribly inward looking if you're not careful. And so every month we get along someone from the outside world. And today we had somebody who runs the Inland Revenue in Scotland. And you might wonder, given some of the history of the tax affairs of the BBC, it was perhaps not a wise invitation. But he was there to talk about how the Inland Revenue has tried over the years to make itself more customer focused. Now you might wonder, what is that relationship with the Inland Revenue? But he did assure us that his major aim now is to help us and not to put us in jail. I think the BBC has still got a lot to learn from that. In other words, who are our customers? How can we satisfy their needs, what they want from the service we deliver? And of course, it's even harder in a world of public service broadcasting when ratings are not paramount. But how do you judge whether something is then successful? And one of the dangers of British television has always been that the success or otherwise is actually decided upon by the people who produced it. And if they liked it and thought it was good, that was enough. Well, I'm not sure that is enough. And you've got to make it more customer-focused, as opposed to necessarily a selling process, but a more customer-focused organisation. What are we trying to deliver? What do the people we're trying to deliver want? And are they satisfied with what we're delivering?
The appointment of a director general is a very public sort of soap opera.
It was this time.
And yours had an unusual amount of Sturm und Drang associated with it. In particular, you were flagellated very publicly for your supposed partisanship because of your deep connection and commitment to the Labour Party. Were you surprised by the ferocity that your appointment aroused in some quarters?
Yes. Because I'd run organisations that were responsible for broadcasting output for many years. I'd always been more interested in the impartiality of broadcasting than my own political ideas. If you go back to when I'd done the McTaggart lecture, 6 or 7 years earlier, the whole lecture was about what I thought was the danger of the relationship between broadcasters and government. That actually, it seemed to me, and it's still there, that in a very fast-changing media world, broadcasters are always wanting something from government, and there's a danger that therefore that means they hold back in terms of their scrutinising role. And I'd always been interested in that sort of stuff. And for me, I'd once considered a politics career. I stood for the GLC in 1977, and it was quite surprising in 1999 to find my GLC manifesto, my GLC election pamphlet, right across two pages of the Times. Particularly as the Times had obviously got it to try to demonstrate that I had been a loony lefty, and were actually really disappointed to discover, and then therefore they wrote up a whole thing saying, even then he was a boring Blairite. But I'm a pretty resilient human being. I suppose in many ways, when the whole thing opened, so I remember people rang me up and said, can we join your campaign? And I said, I'm not going to run any sort of campaign. I mean, the job's around. The headhunters came to see me, asked me, was I interested? I said, yes, I'll go through the process, but I'm not running any sort of campaign. Of course, within 3 weeks, I found this pretty unpleasant campaign being run against me, both in the Times, and largely in the Times and the Daily Mail, which again you'd have expected, but also from within inside the BBC.
Did the element of opposition from within the BBC surprise you, or did you expect to get it as someone who would be perceived as a brash, buccaneering outsider coming in to try to shake up a rather cosy organisation?
I don't think that was the purpose of the opposition from inside the BBC.
But really?
I'm trying to be polite.
Well, that...
I mean, I think that there were a number of people in the BBC who had been encouraged to go for the job, and they went for the job. And I think all sorts of campaigns were around within the BBC. I think it was a pretty unpleasant process inside the BBC. It was not particularly unpleasant for me, but I think it was pretty unpleasant inside the BBC. I'm not sure that when you let five or six people all go for a job in the way they went for it, that's a good idea in an organisation.
Why did you want the job, aside from being flattered by being asked to do it? Why Greg Dyke seeing himself as Director General?
Well, I mean, vanity is always there. You can't take that away. Flattery. I was very interested. It's the major job in broadcasting in this country by a long way. I've long been interested in how you run organisations and how you motivate people. And I think John Bird had done a lot of good things at the BBC, and I think a lot of them have been underestimated. I think he did a lot of good things, but he hadn't got the staff on his side, and it seemed to me that it was a really interesting challenge to see if you could turn the BBC around and get the staff back onto the side of the management. And I thought it was difficult. And I've always, I've moved quite a lot in my career, largely because I'm not very good when I think I've cracked things and find them easy. I thought this was a really difficult thing to do, and I still think it's a difficult thing to do. And there are still days when I go home and think, am I doing this right? Is this the right way to do this? I think it's a very big organisation. It's got a wonderful tradition. I've got into reading bits of the history of it, and the more I read the history, the more fascinated I am by it. Someone today said, what a sad human being I am that I lie in bed reading the history of the BBC between 1965 and 1980, which is what I'm doing at the moment. But what's interesting about it is the same issues that you're struggling with now that you think are unique in your period, you discover they're not unique at all. They've all been there before. I mean, there's some interesting things I've discovered about the BBC by reading the history, in the sense that some people seem to suggest that this was once a coherent organisation where everybody, you know, knew where they were going and went together. Completely untrue. I mean, this was always robber barons. Always. Now, I think you could get away with baronries much easier in 1960 than you can today. Today, the competition is such that you have got to focus on the competition. And as well as focusing on what you're trying to achieve, you've got to focus on what they're trying to do. And you can't do that if the enemy is down the corridor.
If you see, I mean, you know, the history of the BBC is that the enemy was not out there, it was the other department over there. Now, you can't run organisations like that today. You don't succeed.
If you were one of the director generals who became an adjective, what would that mean? I mean, we know what Reithian is, and we sort of know what Burtist or Berthian is. What would Dykean be 10 years from now?
Well, there's so many connotations to that, aren't there? I don't know. I don't think like that.
What would you like to... But what aspect of running a huge broadcaster would you best like your stewardship to represent, do you think?
Well, at the end of the period, two things. Were the programmes better than they were at the beginning? You know, did we make some great programmes? Two, to the people working there, enjoy the process. Had they had a good time? Because I actually think that creative organisations only work if people have a good time. I think the idea that you can achieve success and great programming in an environment that is not exciting and collaborative, I think is not possible.
You and I have both worked at different times for the NHS, which...
No, thankfully, I didn't work for the NHS. Well, I wandered around.
We have both consulted for the NHS.
Yes.
An organisation that employs 1 million people, so it's considerably bigger than the BBC. BBC still is pretty big, though. Is size one of the BBC's problems?
Well, when I ran London Weekend, I mean, everybody who worked for London Weekend worked in one building on the South Bank. It made communication easy. It meant you could have parties, you could celebrate things, and you could... that's harder if you're working for an organisation with 23,000 people, and let alone an organisation that employs 1 million people. I have no idea how you do that.
Neither do they.
Well, you can see it. I mean, it's the toughest management job in Britain, probably in Europe, by a long, long way, running the NHS. But you, thankfully, there are modern communication systems that make life a lot easier. So I use emails a lot, and I send out emails to all the staff on all sorts of things. But I mean, for instance, I mean, we're introducing this enormous new software system right across the BBC, which is a financial and information system. It's costing millions and millions. When I got there, the first thing I did was reviewed it, because my experience of most software systems is that they fail. And they cost you a fortune and they don't work. And we've all got examples. I mean, I could show you probably, you know, several million pounds worth of them already at the BBC that just didn't operate. We reviewed this. We came to the conclusion it was going to work. And then they wanted me to send out an email saying how wonderful this was going to be. And I said, you have to be joking. So I sent an email saying, look, this is going to be a real pain in the arse. Because it always is. But we have got to do it. Because it will save us a lot of money. I mean, for instance, if you're at the BBC at the moment, we have no idea how much money we spend every year with Sony and who does the buying. They're probably bought across 60 different places. Well, you imagine how much cheaper you get all that stuff if you could buy it in one go. And that's the same on everything. And therefore, we needed the system. But you've then got to be honest in the way you communicate it. And email is a great way of doing that. You know, so don't send out them every day, because then no one's going to read them. But every so often, send out an email that says something. So on the day we lost the... match of the day rights, I sent out an email to all the staff just saying, listen, we lost it. Sorry about that. The sports department welcomed it enormously.
Over the last year, we know that you have drastically cut down on the use of outside consultants, apparently reducing expenditure on that from £19 million a year to £3 million a year.
Yep.
You have caused tremendous amount of anxiety amongst people who own chauffeur car companies. You have discouraged the promiscuous eating of croissant.
And that was largely about weight. That wasn't about money.
You've also disbanded the broadcast and production divisions and the independent commissioning group. Which raises the issue of, does every director general have to spend a certain amount of time undoing what his predecessor has done?
Yes. Yes.
Why?
Because all organisations have to change. If you don't constantly change organisations in this world, you will disappear. You have to change. And in the process of change, you make them more efficient. Now, that doesn't mean to say you want to throw out everything. And I certainly haven't thrown out everything. I mean, we've changed the... I mean, one of the most unpopular things at the BBC was the internal market. But if you actually got into finding out what was unpopular, it was minutiae. It was stuff that didn't matter. It was the, you know, paying... having to get a CD out of the CD library cost you £15 and you could buy it at HMV for £12.99. Now, that one story alone, which was known by every MP in Westminster and was used by every member of staff at the BBC at every dinner party, was really damaging what else was happening at the BBC. It wasn't worth it, so we just took it out. The BBC pronunciation unit, not something that I'm... famous for, but the BBC pronunciation unit, you had to pay to use it. Well, if you're in a local radio station in Derby, you couldn't afford to pay to use it, so you didn't use it. Well, what's the point of having a pronunciation unit? You might as well close the thing down. So those sorts of things in the internal market just have to go. But a lot of the internal market has stayed, and there's nothing wrong with internal markets. They make you assess where your costs are, but just don't let it get out of control. What you don't, I mean, we opened a site where we said, here, email us in with the worst excesses of the internal market, and I took them all when I went to Barbados for a holiday, and I lay on the beach and laughed for a week because they were so funny. I mean, and it was just sod's law a lot of the time. You're going up to people and saying, excuse me, can I borrow your sellotape? And they'd say, what's your number? So they were going to charge you. Now, when you think it costs £70 for every time you charged anybody for anything through the system, this was madness. So, but there was nothing wrong with the internal market system. So you don't throw out everything of your predecessor. But all organisations has to change. I mean, I've been at Pearson Television. I'd started it. We built it up into a very large company. But I knew it was time. Either I went or I had to change this thing I'd created. And I didn't really have the appetite to change it. What interests me are the people in you know, really big jobs. Who over 20 years managing to keep doing that. I think they're remarkable leaders. But I think if you don't do that, in this world, you'll die. I mean, I was doing a thing about at the CBI recently, and I looked up about business and business reporting, because one of the things I've tried to change at the BBC is I think our reporting of business is pretty poor. I think we report... We were stuck somewhere in between the 60s and 70s, really. We still reported profit as somehow immoral, you know. I mean, like academic institutions do the same a lot of the time, you know, that somehow making profits was robbing from the consumer. Now, we all know in the world of business that isn't what happens today. The reason Tesco became successful is they understood the consumer. They didn't rob from them. So we wanted to change that. So I want to give the speech at the CBI to talk about this. I've forgotten completely why I was... what I was talking to you about then. what was I saying?
We were talking about the need for organisations to change constantly. Yeah. And your need to change Pearson.
Yeah, and the need to change Pearson, and the need to change... I mean, every organisation I've been in, I think every few years you have to change. And if you don't change it, you will get left behind. I don't know, what I was going to say was, in the research I did for that, I actually showed that if you looked at the FTSE 100 in 1990 and looked at the FTSE 100 in 2000, something like 70% of the companies had gone. And they'd gone because they didn't change. And the great, the great fear at the BBC is don't be Marks and Spencer. And yet, well, it is. And yet, 10 years ago, every big organisation in this country wanted to be Marks and Spencer, but they went. They didn't notice. They didn't see the world change.
But the public, and you know, those of us who get our information about the BBC from the press and from the BBC itself. See flurries of initiatives being introduced by successive director generals, and we get the idea that there is loads of change, but there is no progress.
You must have been reading the Daily Mail.
I never touched it.
No. Well, I don't know what you mean progress is. In the end, how do you judge it? How you judge it is by what's on the screen, or what's on the airwaves, or what the online sites are worth. Because if you don't, that's the only means of judging it. And the rest of it doesn't matter. It's all inner politics and business of politics. It doesn't matter. What's on the screen? Now, if you look at the BBC at the moment, its radio services are going through a wonderful time. I mean, you know, its share is increasing. Radio 2 has been reborn. I mean, it's a revelation to me, Radio 2, because I hadn't listened to Radio 2 for 20 years, or 30 years probably. And I remember, because it was the sort of station my auntie Muriel listened to, and you wouldn't possibly ever listen to that. And then when I got this job, I had to listen to it, and I suddenly thought, actually, this is my sort of music, isn't it? And I couldn't work out whether it was Auntie Muriel got younger or I'd got older. But so, you know, Radio 2 is going through a big success story. Local radio is going through quite a good success story. Radio itself is doing very well. Online, one of John Burt's, I mean, really visionary things was to take the BBC into online. And if you look, we are by far the biggest, the most visited website in Europe. We are the only European competitor with the Americans in the online world. On television, BBC Two is doing okay. BBC One, probably not doing as well. I think BBC One probably lost its way. It'll take us a year, 18 months, I think, to get it back on track. Now, all the tracking studies we do that look at approval for the BBC are quite interesting, because actually they've shown quite a jump after the Olympics, and they've stayed up after the Olympics, because people, I mean, we were quite lucky, because I mean, winning 11 gold medals, which I'm not sure we contributed to, but winning 11 gold medals helped. But I mean, there was a real feeling that the BBC's coverage of the Olympics was outstanding, and it was recognised that by the IOC, who gave us an award for it and all that. But what that, I think, meant to the public was they suddenly valued the BBC more, and actually the approval ratings have went up then and have stayed up. But in the end, you can only be judged by what you are broadcasting, which the rest of it doesn't matter. The rest of it is I'm not even sure people reading, I mean, you would do because you're a groupie, but I mean, I'm not sure that the people, you know, you're a media groupie, but I'm not sure people other than that care less. I mean, the number of times I see these scathing stories about me with a picture of me, and people say, I saw your picture in the paper yesterday. Say, didn't you find it offensive? And they say, oh no, didn't read that. I'm not sure anybody knows, actually.
Can we move on to the longest running question, or a very long running question, which is, why does the BBC as a state broadcaster have to compete?
I don't think we describe it as a state broadcaster.
Well, it is a state broadcaster.
No. It's a publicly funded broadcaster. A state broadcaster is one where the whoever happens to be control of that state at the time has a great deal of influence over the broadcaster.
Well, but
which
if
is
I
what
choose,
you will find in France or in Spain,
yes,
or
but
in
if
Italy.
I, if I choose not to pay my license fee, the state will compel me to pay it, or will punish me.
Well, it will try and persuade you. it will try and persuade you that actually you're not carrying out your civic duty. But it's not a state broadcaster, because a state broadcaster certainly implies some sort of political control of the organisation, and there is no political control of the organisation.
Okay, we'll say a public broadcaster, which the state compels us to support.
That's fair. Yes,
that's fair enough. In that case, why does the BBC continue to compete quite so blatantly with independent broadcasters? Last night, I, you know, like most sensible people, switched on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And on my way to Channel 3, I went past Channel 1, which I believe was showing The Weakest Link.
Yes.
Why? Why compete head on with entertainment?
It wasn't. It was head on with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire for about 5 minutes.
But why even have a 5 minute overlap?
Because the drama up to the 10 o'clock news only lasted 50 minutes. When you move your news at 2 weeks' notice, you do have to make accommodation here or there because all the drama we commissioned for this period was 50 minutes long to run after the news. If you want to play it before the news, you have got a slight gap, so you play around with the schedules for a while. That ends in September, because we won't in September. It'll be hour-long drama rather than 50 minutes. But your basic question is, why do we compete? Well, of course, this has historically been the dichotomy of the BBC. If you go back to the BBC, if you go back into the history again, I'll take you back a bit further. Go back into 1959, the BBC, in a two-channel world, had a 30% share of the audience. So between 1953 and 1959, it had lost 70% of the audience. And it had done that because it was terribly elitist and very nice, but actually wasn't looking at what the audience wanted. Carlton Green, in his period as Director General in the 60s, actually turned it around. And he turned it around by creating modern-day sitcom as we know it, you know, the Steptoes and Sons and all that. By creating modern television drama as we know it. by creating the television production industry in this country. And ITV rapidly lost share and had to chase the BBC to get back, and it got back, and it got back by spending large sums of money on British drama, British comedy, British factual programming. So if you look at the history, the BBC was there first. The BBC created what I call modern popular quality television. ITV chased it and did it quite well. It's not a criticism. I was there at the time, a bit later. But there's nothing that the commercial broadcasters would like more than for us to back off. I think that would be a real mistake. I think it would be a mistake for a number of reasons. First of all, I have no idea what the commercial marketplace will look like in 10 or 15 years' time. There is no doubt that this television market is going to continue to fragment. If that does happen and you lose share year in, year out, which is what is happening to both the BBC and ITV, the BBC, that's not a problem, because the BBC's got a not too great a problem, because the BBC has got a down the source of income, which is a licence fee. Over time, it will be interesting to see whether ITV can sustain the spending on quality British programming that it has done in the past. Because if you do lose share year in, year out, if you're a commercial broadcaster, as the American networks have discovered, you in the end fall off the edge, unless you fundamentally change your cost base. Now, you're beginning to see that in ITV, that they're beginning to change the cost base, change the sort of program. I don't blame them, it's not a criticism. If I was there, I'd be doing exactly the same thing. But I mean, ITV by by the end of this year, certainly, will have four daily soap operas, three daily and one Coronation Street four times a week. Why? Because that's the way that they can get more viewers. How does the BBC respond to that? Do we just let them go? Well, we can't chase them. We can't do four daily soap operas, nor should we, because we have other purposes. But if you want to keep a licence fee funded broadcasting system, you've got to ensure, it seems to me, that the people who are paying the licence fee can find things on your channels that matter to them. And that means mixing programming that is well-made, quality, popular programming with other programming that is not aimed at a popular audience at all. I still think you should try to maximise that audience. I can't see, there's no point being a producer on Panorama and saying I don't care at all what my audience is, which they don't. That's not what they say. What they say is we will try to maximise the audience given the slot we're given and given the present appetite for current affairs. But I mean, therefore, you're trying to do both. I think if you just go down one route, you'll end up where PBS has ended up, or the ABC in Australia has ended up, which is underfunded. In a world when you might find that the commercial marketplace is increasingly forced to rely upon American programming, because the one thing I discovered from my period at Pearson, where we ran production companies in 20 countries around the world, is that in the end there's only two sorts of programming around the world. There's indigenous programming and there's American programming. Now in Britain we've had vastly more indigenous programming than you can see in most societies. Someone came to see me the other day and said, "Ah, but look, you know, there's now a lot of drama in Germany." And I say, "Yeah, but it's not true, is it? I mean, because when I was at Pearson, we made a lot of it. We made, you know, four daily soap operas in Germany, and that's what the investment in drama has been. Now, the investment in drama here has been vastly more than that, and it's important we sustain that because it reflects our culture, and that's what the BBC is. It's a cultural institution that reflects our culture.
As a former student of politics, I'm interested in how you manage the relationship with the government, particularly in the light of Christopher Bland's, your chairman's famous description of our culture secretary as being just another license fee payer.
Yes. That's the sort of thing I say, actually. I said to him, I said, you know, that you're supposed to stop me saying things like that, not you. Carry on.
So how does the relationship with government work?
The There's hardly one at all. I mean, we obviously have to get certain permissions from Secretaries of State to do new services and things like that. But the idea that Alistair Campbell's on the phone every day, which is the sort of suggestions out there, just untrue. I cannot think of a time since I've been there that I've, from either political party, had any sort of attempt to interfere what we're doing. We've had old complaints about, and some of those are right, some of those are fair. And, you know, one of the things I brought in early on is, if we're wrong, let's say we're wrong. You know, and I was actually quite lucky, because early on I went to lunch with a bunch of Conservative MPs who were criticising about our coverage on, just after the Archers had done the most blatant plug for the Labour Party I'd ever heard. And it was so blatant, it couldn't have been intentional. And I just stood up and said, and of course they were all complaining, I just stood up and said, you're right, it was terrible, we're sorry. And it seems to me that's what you should do, because sometimes you do, that's inevitable. The interesting thing about the BBC, and what I think is really the strength of it, is that the editorial power is a long way down the organisation because it's so big. So, you know, there seems to be a belief, and particularly in newspapers, because I think newspapers are different sort of organisations, where the editor does have that influence over a newspaper. He can actually set the whole agenda. The idea that in my job, one, that I could ring up Panorama and say, you ought to do this next week, the only certainty of that is that they'd leak it to all the newspapers. But much... Or not do it. That's the only certainty. But much more than that, why would I want to do that? I mean, what you've got is, we are 50, 60% of broadcast journalism in this country. There are editors to all those bulletins. They make their own decisions. There are editors to all the current affairs shows. They make their own decisions. There are people going off making documentaries. I mean, the most interesting thing is that diversity. The only slightly worrying thing is that every so often something absolutely hits the fan that you've never heard of, and you're being held accountable, and therefore you have to find out pretty quickly. But I mean, that's the strength of the organisation. The strength of the organisation is that the editorial power is quite a long way down, within guidelines. You know, we've got to behave properly and fairly. It's all I ever say, behave properly and fairly. But a long way down, and we defend that independence of the editor of those programmes.
One final question from me, and then we're going to ask for questions from the audience, is that recently, of course, there was a storm of publicity when you described the upper echelons of the BBC as being hideously white.
No, I think I described the whole of the BBC.
Oh, was it the whole of the BBC? I thought it was just the upper echelons.
No.
And I mean, certainly there's no question that the top table of the BBC is particularly so. You've set some relatively modest targets, which I think are that 2-4% of senior managers in the reasonably short term should come from ethnic minorities. How difficult is it going to be to deliver that agenda of making the BBC more representative?
Well, first of all, I mean, let me explain. Hideously white was not actually my terminology. It was quite. I was being interviewed on a radio station and fell for the oldest trick in the book, which was the interviewer said to me, "Do you think the British broadcasting is hideously white?" And I said, "Well, I think the BBC is hideously white." Taking up their word, never thought about it again until it was the front page lead of the Mail on Sunday, and then I realised that maybe was that the wisest phrase to use? Probably not.
Well, it did attract people's attention.
Well, it's created a very interesting position inside the BBC, I think, where I think it certainly brought the issue of race and ethnic minorities to the forefront. Now, you've got to look back at the BBC. If you'd wandered around the BBC, which is what I also said in the interview, I said nothing in the interview, by the way, I hadn't said in a speech at Rima a year earlier and didn't get reported at all. But if you wandered around the BBC a decade and a half ago, you'd have said this was an organisation that was very white and very male. If you walk around it today, it is not very male. There are now, you know, there's a woman controller BBC One, a woman controller BBC Two, a woman controller Radio Four, there's a woman director of radio. So it has changed, and it's changed. Now, that didn't happen by accident. That happened because John Burt put in a policy, both in race and sex, that was about change. In terms of women, it changed. In terms of race, it didn't. It was harder. And we have to look again. And actually, at a meeting I've been at today, we've actually said, look, this is what we will do next year. We've made actually some more money available. This is what we will do to try to change this. Now, one of the questions I was asked wandering around the organisation, because there are some people, Asian woman, who said, because I think she basically said, are you saying if we're interviewing someone for a job and one's white and one's black and the black one's nearly as good, we should give them the job? And I said, under no circumstances. You have got to give the jobs to the best people. I just do not believe that there are not people from different ethnic backgrounds who could do some of these jobs. And therefore, we've got to look very closely at the BBC about why not? Why aren't they there? How do we do something about it? It's not an issue only for the BBC. It's an issue for many organisations. But if the BBC can't do something about it, who can? So we've got a whole programme of what we will try to do. We'll push it through. It's a priority. It's in every executive director's priorities. Their bonuses are related to a number of things, but one of them is that. Because it's easy to put it in your priorities. Yeah, actually, you just say, well, I got eight, but I didn't get that one. So we've got to. It's got to be a serious issue across the whole organisation. Now, I've also got a lot of emails from ethnic minority staff inside the BBC saying, thank you, because I feel better now. And when I was, for this thing I was doing with the staff yesterday, I got pulled out, I said, look, show me the figures, how is this going to change? Let's look at, because I knew that the change, I read somewhere that the change in the conurbations in this country is going to be quite marked in terms of ethnic groups over the next decade or so. The figures I got back said that in London, by 2012, 50% of the population will be non-Anglo-Saxon white. 50%. Now, we employ 75% of our staff in London. If we don't reflect that quite quickly, one, we're not fulfilling our duty, I don't think, as a public sector organisation, but I think it also means... Why do you want to bring in people of different ethnic backgrounds? Because they bring in something with them in the back of the boat, just like I did. You know, I was born in West London, went to school in Hayes, and because of that, I bring something about that community, that area, that organisation. That's what you want. You want people who are fine for the job. They can do it perfectly well. But they also, their mum came from Trinidad, or their dad was an East African Asian, and their parents were East African Asian and came from Kenya. And they bring something else. And that's what you want in an organisation today. And this country is still, I think, quite a way behind what you see in the United States now. That's accepted in the United States. And we have got to do it. We've got to do it within the terms of the law. But we've got to do it. And we've got to do it for the good of the BBC, for what we're trying to do in terms of our audiences, and for the good of what this society is going to be in 20 years' time.
Shall we have some questions now? Please identify yourselves and no programme proposals.
Hello, it's a tradition that I get the first question in. Roger Bush, Media Society, and Institute of Journalists. Bearing in mind Mr. Dyke's background in independent, not to say commercial, television, how much of a handicap have you found it in going to the BBC, where you haven't got advertisers? Now, I mean that in the sense that, in a way, advertisers give you a focus. You are satisfying them, whether it's niche advertisers or mass advertising. In the BBC, you haven't got that. How do you keep in touch with your constituency? Audience research? Enough of it?
Oh, we have... We have audience, you can imagine, the BBC is the BBC. We have audience research coming out of our ears. We do a lot of focus groups, a lot of audience research. We were talking this morning about saying, actually, we should probably all spend more time out going out meeting in focus groups and things, just to meet chunks of the audience, find out what it's about and most. I don't think we ever thought in ITV really that advertisers were our clients in that way. I think it's more so now, but it certainly wasn't in my early years there. Remember, ITV for a long time had a monopoly on the sale of advertising, and we saw our clients as the general public. we had to attract advertising, but that was largely being sold by these people over here who were the sales department. And I mean, I actually, it was always a weird system. I mean, because it was a monopoly, you know, if your audiences went down, the advertising rates went up and actually made more money. So, you know, when I was at TVS in the south of England, which had the lowest, at that time, the lowest ratings of any region in Britain, it was the, outside of London, the richest advertising revenue, because if you wanted to advertise in the south of England, you had to advertise with us. We were the only people. And because they didn't watch as much, you had to advertise more to get on. But the airtime was finite, therefore you paid more. Straight economics. Nobody outside of the advertising industry understood it at all, but it worked perfectly. Certainly for TVS, anyway. I don't think we saw... I don't find the difference... the difference of running the organisation is different, because I'd run profit, you know, I'd been a chief executive running profit and loss organisations and wasn't responsible necessarily for programming. It does come back to what I was saying at the beginning. How do you judge it? It's tougher. How do you judge it? How do you judge what's a successful programme? Some it's clear. If you've seen Simon Sharma's A History of Britain, you just know that will go down as a great programme and a great series, and you know, there's more to come. There are some things you just know. There are some things the audience will tell you. There are some things. I mean, why A Weakest Link? Because A Weakest Link was put onto BBC Two at 5:15, and over a period of 10 weeks, grew from 1 million audience to 5 million audience, and it's now by far the biggest rated show on either BBC One, on either BBC Two or Channel Four. Why? Because the audience wanted it. They liked it. The BBC Two audience sorted out. And therefore, we decided we would make a BBC One version for one day of the week.
Next question, Roger.
I'm Roger Silverstone from the London School of Economics. I've got a double-headed question, Greg, really. I'd like to push a little bit on what you mean by public service and how you see BBC fulfilling what you envisage or imagine or would like to call public service over the next 4 years, and what you see the major threats as being.
Well, public service has changed, and it changes over the years. And I mean, one of the clever things about the BBC over the years is that it changed over time, each director general changed it to respond to certain audiences. So Carlton Green changed it fundamentally from what was set up really by Reith and so on. I see public service as making and broadcasting, making commissioning and broadcasting brilliant programming of all sorts, of all types, some aimed at the popular market, some not at all, but you've got to have that mix. But it's about the quality of what you do. It's the quality of the programming. Things have changed. The days when you could play a very popular program at 7 o'clock and a very popular program at 8 o'clock, and half an hour you could put in something that nobody would want, you know, wasn't necessarily aimed at the majority audience, but they'd stay with it. They've all gone. The audience moves all over the place. Actually, if you ever look at the figures for how long an audience stays with any program, it's quite frightening. People move in and move out in a way that they wouldn't have done in the past. There are no such thing, I think, as BBC viewers. You know, I'm totally loyal to the BBC, and I turn it on at 7 o'clock and turn it off. It's all gone. Therefore, my view of, say, BBC One is you're not always trying to maximise audience, but what you want is a service that has impact. And that's what I say talking to the Panorama people, where we're spending more money, because I think we could well end up being the only people left doing that sort of in-depth investigation. And I think that has a real purpose in a democracy. But the aim isn't, the aim isn't whether you get 3.5 or 4. The aim is, what is the impact of what you're trying to do? What do I think of the threats? Well, in the very short term, we have a license fee agreement till 2006. But obviously, it's a tougher market today. There are more competitors. For many years, there was an agreement, really, between ITV and BBC. The BBC was funded by a license fee. ITV had a monopoly on advertising, and it was a cosy duopoly. Well, that's all gone. Therefore, you now find in anything new that you want to do or you want to change, you'll find quite significant opposition. I mean, we're planning to do, as part of our new services, two new children's channels for daytime. That will go on two of our existing digital channels. And, I mean, you know, really vociferous opposition from Nickelodeon, from Disney, from Fox, B-Sky B. And our argument back is, but hang on, let's look at your services. With the exception of Nickelodeon, the Nickelodeon service for little kids, which is largely BBC Library product, the rest of it is 90% American, advertiser-funded. We've now consulted the public, and we found that sort of way over 85%, I think about 87%, supported the idea of children's channels made up largely of British product, which is not funded by advertising. It will be interesting to see who wins out. Now, if we start getting severely constrained, I'm not thinking we should expand it to everywhere because we haven't got enough money, nor should we. But if we that pressure from the commercial sector grows, and we start getting severely constrained, and we start getting driven out of making popular drama and those sorts of things, then I think it's a real threat to the BBC. I think you're then onto a spiral where you increasingly find it difficult to justify the licence fee. Whereas I don't think that will happen. I actually think people will see the value of the BBC much more clearly in a decade's time than maybe some see it today. The other interesting thing, of course, is, you know, when you take this job, soon after I took it, I went back to do a couple of days on a course at the Harvard Business School where I'd been a decade earlier. And just, you go to a place like that in that sort of environment of by and large successful Americans, and you talk about running the BBC, you cannot believe how much, what they think of it and how much it's revered as you go around the world. And I find that everywhere I go. And sometimes you think, you sit in this country and you think, this is nuts, isn't it? The sort of criticism and attacks that come on an organisation at times that is actually held up around the world as the great example of independent broadcast, of an independent quality broadcaster.
We have time for one more question. Lady behind Bob Worcester. You need a microphone.
Okay. You said you needed money, talent and luck, but surely you also need some form of protective legislation. I mean, protection for the licence fee into the future is one thing. I mean, what I actually had in mind was a possible an upcoming Communications Act, which places the BBC in a much broader context of, as you say, more ferocious market pressures, and a white paper which promises forms of protection for a public service ideal, which, you know, includes other things as well as quality, like diversity and like a spread of programmes and so on. I was just wondering what your feeling is in relation to upcoming legislation.
Well, we could nitpick bits of the white paper, but by and large we thought it was fairly sensible. My particular concern was that I was very anxious that we didn't have a single content regulator in this country. I don't mind having a single economic regulator, that's easy, you know, about competition policy and all that sort of stuff. But a single content regulator I thought was, in terms of a democracy, quite dangerous. Because there is no doubt politicians will try and nobble regulators. I mean, it happens. I mean, you know, why in the end did ITV move their news back to 10 o'clock? Because the regulator was nobbled by the politicians. Now, that's always happened, always will happen, but you want plurality in therefore you want plurality in regulation just as you want plurality in broadcasters. And what you don't want is a single content regulator. And that's not going to... And there was some suggestion that might happen at one time. Thankfully, that's not going to happen. And I think as to the rest of it, well, it's so much more of it is about the telecoms industry than about us. So, but I don't... I think by and large we find that most of the white paper is pretty sensible. We'd all want to change old bits, but then so does everybody. And we, no doubt we'll all try.
We've been given dispensation for one more question, so let's have a really cracking one. Gentleman right there.
Thank you. Oscar Rodriguez Aguilar, I was postgraduate student here at the LSE, and then I became an economics commentator. When I worked at the World Service, I had some thoughts of questioning that, after I've heard you say a few comments, have made me think, and I was wondering if you could clarify two points. When I was there, we were paid by the Foreign Office. Would that not make us, perhaps, our salaries were paid by the Foreign Office? Would that not make the World Service state-linked, perhaps? Yep. And the second point was regarding the internal market. At some stage, I'm one of those that left, I'm afraid, 2 years ago. At some point, we had outside consultants coming to the Latin American section of the World Service where I worked, asking us all about what we did in order to make cost-effective models of obviously cheaper programs, which I think in the end diminished the creativity that was being put in some programs. So my question would be, would those aspects that Mr. Burt put into place then still be, or would they still be carried out now under your directorship?
I mean, you're right about the World Service. The World Service is Foreign Office funded, but it's fiercely independent editorially of Foreign Office lines. Some of those changes that John made are there, and we're right. Some we've changed, and some we're still looking at, is the answer. Some we've made a lot of changes, some we've moved back. We have reintegrated in a lot of areas. There was no point having a separate resources division for news if its only customer was news. What was the point? Well, you do it because you sort out efficiency, but once you've done it, you might as well put them back together again. And I expect someone else in 5 years' time to take up your theme will do it again. But in terms of the World Service, because of our particular relationship with the Foreign Office, we haven't changed that much at this particular time, but we probably will change more later.
Right, thank you very much. Before we break up, we have a brief a presentation. Let me just slip out of this chair for a minute. In a beautiful LSE carrier bag.
Well, I'm very excited by the look of this.
I'm afraid it doesn't sound like an honorary doctorate. Take that home and
thank you
open
much.
It at your leisure. We also have the LSE baseball cap, as worn fetchingly on many occasions by Nelson Mandela.
Thank you.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
And finally, on pain of death.
It's a bit like a game show, this.
And on pain of death, I had to promise our head of development that I would attempt to make everyone wear an LSE tie. So there you are. Thank you all very much indeed for joining us, and thank you very much indeed, Greg. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. If I can delay you just another couple of minutes. Thank you, Brunswick and Contact Consulting, for sponsoring this, and Reggie Simpson and Clive Jones for fixing it. There's some drinks in the senior common room, which is on the fifth floor. If you're fit, I would walk. That's for the next hour or so. It's free to members of the media group and the media society. £5 if you're not a member, £2 if you're a student. We've had a very busy programme this year. We've had Edwina Curry, Alan Rusbridger, Alan Davis, Basil Jett, Michael Jackson, Peter York, and now Greg Dyke. And the year hasn't finished yet. On March 7th, you'll see in front of you, there's an event called Private Lives, Public People, which has the editor of The People, the editor of Dispatches, the Privacy Commissioner, the solicitor who defended, the barrister who defended Catherine Zeta-Jones's privacy, and one or two others. And then, finally in the summer, there's two or three little treats. There's a man called Michael Philip Jagger, who I think once came here for a year or so, who has agreed to accept an honorary degree and to talk about his life and times to a man called Ray Connolly. Ray Connolly wrote the standard Beatles biography, and as an old boy, he got a degree, Jagger didn't. And also, we're going to try after the general election, I think on Tuesday, May the 8th, to have a session called Who Won the TV Election? with the editors from BBC, ITM, Channel 4 and Sky, because that's the real election, not what happens on May the 3rd. And we may have a party in the summer as well. Please join us upstairs, five floors up, the senior common room. You will be asked for money on the door. Thank you for coming.